And for no generation was that more dramatic than mine that was born in the period after the Second World War, free education, free healthcare, virtually full employment. I lived in this city. I didn't meet in my 20s anyone who was unemployed. An amazingly good quality of life. And now things are much more uncertain. And broadly, there are three big crises that will dominate both the short and long term of your life. Much the worst of these is climate change. Don't believe any of these people that question the science. The science is overwhelming. When we opened the Thames Barrier at the GLC in 1982, we had to raise it twice a year to prevent London being flooded. At the moment, it's being raised two or three times a month. And the government is already, I was arguing with the government before I lost the election about how rapidly we needed to build a new, bigger barrier a bit farther out to sea, because at some point, the existing barrier won't be enough and London could be flooded. It'd be absolutely catastrophic. It'd be an economic blow from which the city would never recover, because it would take about 2 years to get the underground system and dry and working again. By the time things were getting back to normal, many of the great firms that generate so much of the wealth in London would have gone somewhere else and they wouldn't be coming back. So the scale of this is no one denies how bad it's going to be. What scientists aren't clear about is how rapidly. If we're lucky, it will be really catastrophic in the second half of this century. If we're unlucky, it could start to be really catastrophic 10, 15 years down the road. And no one knows, because there are all these things, feedback loops, as the ice melts, the sea warms up more quickly. And the mayor of New York has built shelters for 2 million citizens, because they know as the North Atlantic Ocean gets a bit warmer, it gives a vast amount of energy to fuel the hurricanes. They've never had a hurricane more than force two. They know that they'll eventually have a force three and a force four, and all of New York up to Wall Street will be inundated. So he's had to build shelters for 2 million people. Basically, a quarter of the population of the city will have to flee the waves as they come crashing in. And so around the world, people are starting to plan for this. I mean, in London and New York, where we have a lot of money, it's relatively easy. If you're Bangladesh, an incredibly poor country, where something like 15 to 20% of the land, all of it inhabited, densely inhabited, will be inundated by the sea as the ice caps melt. And there is nowhere else in Bangladesh. There's not vast bits of Bangladesh that are empty. There's nowhere else for people in Bangladesh to move to. This will be a refugee problem on a scale the world has never seen. If you look at what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa, the desert moves farther south each year. And although we don't tend to think in terms of any one item being directly linked to global warming, the sort of catastrophic floods you've seen in Pakistan this year, the incredible fires in Europe and America and Australia last year, because those areas are getting drier. And of course, in sub-Saharan Africa, the spread of the desert. And basically, countries which at the moment are just about manageable are going to become largely uninhabitable. So you will live through a world of literally hundreds of millions of refugees from climate change. And we have, as I say, no idea how quickly this is going to happen. Fortunately, the problem's resolvable. When people talk about what we have to do to stop climate change, everyone switches off because they think it's all doom and gloom. You'll have to carve your own shoes out of tree bark, grow your own muesli, build a mud wattle hut or something as society collapses. None of that is true. What we find is that if we just stop waste, you can reduce our carbon emissions. Even though China and India and Latin America are increasing their carbon emissions, if you actually maximize the efficiency of the energy we use, we can solve the problem. We can get carbon emissions down to a point where the world's population would be stable again. All it requires is political courage for leaders to say to people the changes we need to make. It just means not wasting anything. It means not leaving lights on. It means having energy-efficient light bulbs. It means when you buy a kettle or a washing machine, you buy the one that uses the least energy. It means don't flush the toilet if you only had a pee. because all that water has been purified to drinking quality standard, costing a vast amount of energy. All these small things, not wasting food, recycling. If you've got a garden, recycling your household waste in with your clippings and lawnmower bits and all that. All of it manageable. All it requires is we develop a mentality of not wasting. And that's the huge shift, because we've just lived through the best part of 3/4 of a century where the concept of waste has been built into the way we live. Starting in Madison Avenue, the advertising center of America in the 1920s. Up until then, people bought the things they needed to survive. They didn't have so much money. They could just, except for a very small, rich elite. It was about buying things you didn't need. And so advertising created a sense of need, gave a sense of prestige, and this has spread from America to Europe, and dangerously now is taking hold in India and in China and in Latin America, that we feel our worth is judged by what we own, what we consume, and you take it to the extreme example of footballers on tens of millions of pounds leading an absolutely mad life where they squander wealth in a gross way. If we could get back to a world in which people thought in terms of what they need, because I have to say, I've met some of the richest people in the world. Rupert Murdoch, another one that most of you won't be old enough to remember, who used to own the Daily Mirror, Robert Maxwell, or as Conrad Black, who's currently doing time for defrauding his shareholders in jail. And the thing about Maxwell and Black is they were both worth tens of millions of pounds, but they were mixing with people worth billions of pounds and they felt inadequate. And so they stole from their employees and their shareholders so they could live a higher quality of life. There really isn't a point where if you're driven only by what you're worth, what you can buy, that you're ever going to be happy or satisfied with that, because there's always someone earning more. And therefore, we've got to get back to understanding society in which we value more the time we have with our friends and our family, the things that give us value in a community. If we can get back to that, these problems become soluble. But if the billions of people in Africa and Asia and Latin America end up adopting our sort of standard and way of life and our obsession with personal consumption, then, this problem is not soluble. So that's a problem that's going to be running right the way through your lives and your children's lives. And we have to get it right, or there's no guarantee human society can survive with a succession of environmental catastrophes. People say, politicians will move and the public will wake up when large numbers of people die. The environmental charities all calculate that about 100,000 people at least, perhaps as many as 300,000 a year, are already dying of climate change. But they're dying in Africa and Asia from flooding or starvation because the land they had has become a desert. And that doesn't register with Western journalists and the media. So this is a background problem, and it will never go away throughout your lives. If we don't get it right, there's no guarantee your grandchildren will have anything we recognise as a decent quality of life. The second problem is we're living through a reversal of a power shift that happened 200 or 300 years ago. A power went from all around the world to be concentrated in America and Europe. Initially Europe, then more latterly America. If an alien race had arrived on this planet 300 years, 400 years ago, they wouldn't have thought of going to America or Europe. These were quite backward areas. They would have gone to the great civilizations of India and China. And it was really only 200, 220 years ago that Europe overtook India and China in terms of the size of its economy. And it did it not just by building up Britain and France and so on, but it did it by tearing down those cultures, subjecting them to imperialism, and in Africa, of course, even more devastating, and making, in today's terms, hundreds of billions of pounds out of slavery. And then, because of the military power that France and Britain had amassed, and then America, we forced the world to be organized on the lines that we wanted. So all, and this still continues today, so all over the world, countries in Africa and Asia have to buy the goods that we produce in Europe and America on our terms, and we deny them the right to sell us the goods they can produce. Now, this is beginning to break down because China just became the second largest economy in the world. India will most likely overtake America before the middle of this century. And that's a world that's going to, that change of power economically will change basically everything about the nature of the way we live our lives as well. For my generation, my parents' generation, my grandparents, they got the crumbs of this great enterprise. The great corporations and the aristocrats took the bulk of it, but ordinary workers in Europe and America had a much more comfortable life than people in Africa or Asia, because they got a small proportion of the vast profits we made out of this. I mean, therefore today, there'll be more and more challenges to that system. I mean, America at the moment is whining that the Chinese currency is undervalued, and therefore Chinese goods are flooding into America and everyone's buying them. I should imagine your home's filled with Chinese goods as well. And the Chinese economy has massively expanded. But what they don't say is that all over the world there are people in poor countries growing cotton, and they can't make a decent living out of that because America still produces cotton and subsidises the great corporations that own the cotton fields with billions of pounds a year. And there's no way poor farmers can get that sort of support from countries in Africa or Asia. And you can find almost any aspect of trade, it's rigged against the poor. The emergence of China and India behind means you're getting countries that are going to be more powerful than already, as I say, China's the second most powerful economy in the world. It will most probably, in real terms, become the largest by about 2017, 2018, 2019. If you were to think in terms of who's going to be powerful at the middle of this century, three people meeting in a room will effectively be in control of the majority of the world's economy. The President of America will still be number three, and the Prime Minister of India will be number two, and the President of China will be number one. And behind them, there'll be Brazil and Japan, and you're going to get a long way down before you find Britain. Certainly the only European country anywhere close to that is going to be Germany. So this is a huge shift of power. What's it going to mean for your lives? At the moment, you do quite well out of it. We're able to buy an awful lot of electronic goods that you probably couldn't afford to buy if they'd been made here rather than in China. And if we're open and honest with the rest of the world and we can agree a package of changes that adjust to this, that will be fine. If it descends into trade wars or even real wars about who controls these resources, who determines the pattern of trade, it will be catastrophic. But what it does mean is that we are going to be competing against people who are working harder and investing more than we do. The reason China has done so well isn't because its currency is undervalued. That's a minor factor. It's because in China, 46% of the wealth they create each year, they use to invest. They invest it in building new infrastructure. They invest it in modern new industries. They invest it in the quality of the education they give to their young people. I opened an office in Shanghai and Beijing and a couple of offices in India while I was mayor to try and drum up trade, attract tourists and so on. The local woman I appointed to run our office in Shanghai told me about her school career. For 9 years, she was at school at 7 o'clock every morning and she left at 6 o'clock every night. Now, not every child in India is getting an education of that intensity or that quality, but more and more are, and those are the people you will compete against the rest of your life. If I said to you, what's the biggest item of household spending in China? We could spend hours here as people going about food or clothing or entertainment. The biggest single item of spending by a Chinese family is on extra education classes for their kids. They spend more on that than on food. So as well as doing this sort of 7 to 6, then at the weekends and evenings, there's other stuff that the family is spending on. That's why you actually combine these two factors, that amazing level of investment, both in infrastructure and research and development, and in their education system. If you can get the odds on this at your local bookmaker, for those of you old enough legally to bet, if you put 10 quid now on the next person to walk on the moon being Chinese and the first person to walk on Mars being Chinese, I guarantee you're going to win that bet. There is no way now America could mobilize the wealth to actually do that. When President Kennedy decided America should send a rocket to the moon and land a man and bring him back, it meant for 6% of their wealth each year for 10 years was diverted to do that. And what's happened in Britain and America and Europe, as China and India invest more and more, we've been investing less and less. We're mostly doing about 15% of our annual wealth. And that means we're not putting the money into research and development. And as you're painfully aware of, we're about to start cutting the amount we invest in our students. And the one simple equivalent bit of spending here. We could, over the last 10 years, have given free education to everyone in further and higher education for 10 years, just for the money we have spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So when you hear politicians of whatever party telling you we can't afford this anymore, I mean, remind them whenever there's a war, they always manage to mobilize the money that they need. And then the final problem, perhaps in a sense the smallest, though it's going to be the most painful in the short term, is our own economic problems here in Britain. As well as planning for climate change, adjusting to the growth of China and India and Brazil, we've also got our own problems. And this is the thing that I get quite angry about, because there's this mantra from the government that we're in this terrible mess because the last Labour government spent too much money. I never thought it spent enough, actually, when I looked at the lack of good housing for people to rent, the failure to provide free education. They did quite a lot, actually. In our schools, teachers 13 years ago, an average teacher was on about £20,000 a year. Over the following 12 years, we got that up to about 32. And that meant more teachers stayed, there was more stability in the schools. And in a borough like Hackney, where in 1997, only about a quarter of kids were getting five good GCSEs, that figure's now up, I suspect it's by now, it's over 50%. And there's been some investment. But the idea we were spending too much is absolute nonsense. What we were doing, and getting wrong, was just not spending enough of that in investing in infrastructure, in building more housing for people to live in, building actually better tube trains and extending the rail network and things like that. And also particularly investing in creating new high-tech jobs. One way to tackle the problem of climate change is to insulate every home and office and school in the country. That would create good, well-paid jobs, high-quality jobs. It would actually create a huge new market building the photovoltaic cells, the solar panels, the wind farms, and all the new smart technologies we're just on the verge of developing. And the countries actually that make that stuff will be selling it to the rest of the world when everybody wakes up to the fact climate change is going to be much worse and much quicker than they actually anticipate. So we weren't spending too much. If you actually look, before the banking crisis hit, Britain's debt was 40 to 42% of its annual income. That is the smallest of any large Western economic power. Most of them were 60 to 65%, America, France, Germany, and so on. What turned that round so that we are now up there at 62% is, of course, the banking crisis. And it makes me incredibly angry to think that whilst you're going to lose your education maintenance allowance, and have to pay, those of you going on in the education system, have to pay increased tuition fees, that the bankers who created this crisis are back on their inflated salaries, back on their bonuses. And if you look, not just the bankers, but all those other great captains of industry who told governments, Labour and Tory, this is the route you've got to go. In the last year, the chief executives of the 100 largest firms that are listed on our stock exchange have had a pay increase of 55%. That's happening while you're losing your education maintenance allowance. I suspect some of them were earning almost enough that they themselves could pay for the entire education maintenance allowance in London, frankly. And this is what is wrong with our society. It is the inequalities of wealth, and they've got worse. For my generation, the reason we had a whale of a time, the reason we had everything free, was year by year the inequalities of wealth got less. when very rich people died, there was a big tax on their estates, and a lot of it's redistributed. And so it should be, because most of them, their ancestors back in the Middle Ages, stole it from somebody else. Most of them didn't get it by hard work. You've got to accept as well that we had a much more progressive tax system. So somebody, even the first 8 years of Mrs. Thatcher's government, the top rate of tax was 60%. Now, it's gone up from 40% to 50%. I think that's a good first step. But when you've got someone like Bob Diamond, who runs our largest bank, being paid £11 million a year, and what can you spend all that on? You know, if you actually redistribute the wealth through the tax system, so poor people pay less, rich people pay more, it has a huge impact on the whole economy. Because people in the bottom half of society get money, they spend it on goods and services locally, they create more jobs, it helps fuel our economy. If someone like Bob Diamond is given another £2 million on his bonus, he'll most probably invest it in something internationally. It'll most probably have no impact on our economy at all. And that's why my generation had a better quality of life, and yours is facing a worse one. And we have to challenge this and simply say, there's no law laid down by any form of God that says rich people have to get richer and richer at the expense of the rest who are held back and can't achieve their full potential. And so in the political struggles to come, which we're going to see much more intense, we've got to get in our own mind, what do? A fairer tax system, investing more in the future, investing in those new green technologies. And here's the point I end on, and I think it's London's biggest selling point, being open to the world that's being born. If we try and erect barriers against China and India and Brazil and Africa, if we are saying we don't want foreigners coming here, if we want to become an isolated island, we will lose a lot of our dynamism. Because London is the only city in the whole of Europe that matches American levels of competitiveness and productivity. And that is because we're the most open city in Europe. There is no other city in Europe where a third of its people were born abroad. I'm not talking about black and Asian Londoners who've been born and brought up here. One person in three in the city was born in a foreign country and has come here to be a Londoner because they enjoy this city, to actually create and generate wealth. 15 of the 25 richest people in this city were born abroad, they came here, and they've helped create the city around us. If you look at the only other city in the world like us, it's New York. Exactly the same pattern. And when we had the bombings on the underground back in 2005, the thing that amazed the rest of the world was just the way in which the city stood together. Didn't matter what your race or your religion, there was no attack. In many other cities, an attack like that leads to communal violence afterwards. This is a city that is comfortable with people being different. And that is its huge strength. Not only is it a huge strength that makes this an attractive place to be a student or a visitor or come to make your life and invest and work, it actually, I believe, is a template for the rest of humanity. If the world can emerge into the concept that we're actually all human, and that's more important than differences of faith and colour, then there's a future you can see a way through all. And I think in that sense, your generation is much more likely to achieve that than mine or the one in between. Because yours is the generation that, as long as you can afford it with a computer, an iPhone, iPad, BlackBerry, is able to surf the internet around the world and choose what you like of other cultures, not to feel threatened by them. And I think a young generation growing up across the world will be communicating directly with each other, dipping into different cultures, taking what they find best. And I believe that's the future for humankind. If we get it right, all these other problems are soluble, but only if we recognize our common humanity. Thank you very much.